This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tis the season to shop. This time of the year, catalogs stream through our mailboxes, pop-ups proliferate on the internet, magazines and newspapers grow fat with seductive advertising. The pressure and desire to buy may crest in the run-up to the holidays, but shopping is an integral part of our lives, part of our routine. Whether your pleasure is wandering through malls, window shopping, surfing the net, or the solace of the bookstore, decisions about what to buy and where to buy it is one of the ways we define ourselves. Sociologist Sharon Zukin argues that shopping is the universal equalizing force in American life. Later in this program, James Carville joins us to talk about the problems that presidential candidates can talk themselves into. Plus, NPR President Kevin Close will be here to talk about a very large donation that NPR received today. But first, shopping and American culture. Join the conversation. How much thought do you give to where and how and why you shop? Who taught you how? Has your shopping changed as your life circumstances change? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Sharon Zukin joins us now from our bureau in New York. She's a sociology professor at CUNY Graduate Center in Brooklyn College. And her new book is Point of Purchase. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
Few would argue that American shopping is a vital part of the American economy. You go beyond that, though. You argue that it's also central to American culture. How so?
Shopping is perhaps the most unexamined part of American culture. We take it for granted. Places to shop are all around us, not just in shopping malls and downtown shopping streets, but in the very centers of our home, on the internet, on our television, through our mailboxes. Shopping comes to us, and we go out to shop almost every day, whether we love it or we hate it or we find it difficult to talk about. How we shop, how we provide the means of our survival, as well as the luxuries, is what we're all about.
Mm-hmm. As you say, it is part of the routine. But, you know, all of us, you know, how does it define us?
It's not just the things we buy that define us. In fact, that's the point of my title. The point of shopping is not just the point of purchase. It's the whole experience that we can't escape and that we seek out. We shop through our lives. We shop with our parents when we're babies in strollers. We're taken to the mall or to the supermarket. We shop when we're old. I went to the supermarket recently with my mom, who's now 90 years old. She couldn't see very well, and she couldn't walk very well, but her body had so internalized the order of the supermarket that she grabbed hold of that cart, and she wanted to roll right to where she knew the bananas were. We categorize ourselves by our pursuit of what we need to survive. And these days, we don't make those things anymore. We buy them. How do we buy them? We shop for them.
It's interesting. You talked about supermarkets, and one of the interesting things I read in your book was that the design of supermarkets, when they were first introduced, people were worried about shoplifting, and they put turnstiles in.
That's right. You can think about pictures you may have seen of the old country store, usually men sitting around the potbelly stove and usually exchanging humorous gossip on a Saturday afternoon, the women coming in to shop for fabrics or candies for the children, and certainly for some of those necessities like sugar and flour that they needed to bake their own bread at home. But the supermarkets were a dramatically new invention in the late 19th century, and then late 19th century for the chain stores like A&P, mm-hmm. and then in the early 20th century, the 1920s, early 1930s, people literally had to sit down and think, how are we going to arrange goods so that shoppers can come right up to them? They don't have to ask a clerk. By the way, lowering labor costs was always a huge issue for grocery store owners. And we want those shoppers to grab those goods themselves. We want them to buy a lot. But, hey, we don't want them to walk out of the store with the goods in their pockets. So, yes, the creator of one of the first supermarket chains, I think it was the owner of Piggly Wiggly, said, well, let's control the consumers. Let's guide the shoppers when they come into the store. Let's not let them come into the store in a mob, but the turnstiles will permit them to enter one by one, and then we're going to kind of guide them through the motion of the turnstile toward the first aisle. And those gondolas, which were again created in the early 20th century, were deliberately set up in a maze so that shoppers would wheel their carts up and down every single kind of good in the supermarket and finally wind up at the cash registers where the cashiers could survey the contents of their baskets.
And the gondolas are the structures.
Those are the display car. Yes, the display structures. Yes.
Okay, and so we're maneuvered essentially back through all of the aisles to the milk, which is all the way in the back. So if you want the milk, and that's something everybody wants, you got to see the whole store.
Exactly.
And that's still the way they are today.
Still, no change whatsoever, except that the aisles are now as wide as boulevards. The carts are as big as SUVs.
The interesting progression you describe also is the old corner variety store that then moved on to the five and dime that, mm-hmm. that Woolworth invented and you argue Walgreens perfected. And then that eventually goes on to the giant big box stores we have today.
That's correct. The genesis of Walmart is in Woolworth and the variety stores of the 1870s. I think that Americans at that point made a Faustian bargain with bargain culture. And those superstores and big boxes that I think are today's satanic mills actually began with the fascination with the first mass-produced goods, the first mass-produced consumer goods in the 1870s back in the old variety stores.
So this is a progression, but when you talk about the bargain culture, the values that we put on things, what do you mean by that?
People love low prices. That's what Walmart banks on. In the last few months, when the news has been rife with stories about Walmart lowering their costs by putting pressure on their suppliers, pressure on their workers, pressure on their outside contractors.
And hiring a bunch of illegal aliens to clean the store. Yes.
Exactly. These really have been folded into the low prices that American consumers have benefited from for the past 150 years. The lack of clerks in self-service stores, not just Walmart, but supermarkets and now all the department stores.
Mm-hmm.
The constant sales, as Walmart advertises, low prices every day. All of these things took us away from more traditional ways of seeing, more traditional ways of doing business. And they've pressured all of us into thinking that buying goods for the lowest price is the greatest benefit that we can get from consumer society.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email TOTN at NPR.org. And let's go to Janice, who's on the line with us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a few comments to make about shopping. I'm one of those rare women that I hate shopping. It is a very stressful situation for me. I go in, whether it be at a Walmart store or a grocery store, I go and I get what I need and I'm out of there.
Hmm.
I very much shop with coupons, and sometimes even for clothing I shop at a secondhand store. One of the issues that I have problems with is every store, every weekend, for every holiday, everything is on sale, and I can't understand how everything can be on sale all the time.
That's a pretty good question, but I guess it's to Sharon Zukin. The marketers are trying to get people into the stores.
Exactly. Janice, you are not alone. What I found by talking with a number of shoppers in and around New York City is that shoppers are rational, and a lot of people respond to the constant state of sales in stores by finding alternatives, just as you do, shopping in thrift stores, using coupons. We are pressured all the time by advertising and by the store's promotions, and also increasingly by retail sites on the internet to buy and to buy all the time. But more and more people are looking for alternatives.
Absolutely. Well, I do want to let you know that I'm teaching my 14-year-old daughter how to be checkbook savvy when we do go shopping for her, say, like for school clothes, too.
Excellent.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for my call.
Thanks very much, Janet. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's get another caller on. Tom is with us from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hello.
Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Yes, well, thank you. I just came to Memphis, and I went through the prototype of the first Piggly Wiggly store, the first supermarket that your guest was talking about, and it's a whole museum built around this store. It's really quite interesting, the concept.
The brands, I assume, are back to You Need a Biscuit and that sort of thing.
Well, the brands were, you don't see many of the brands anymore, but it was a maze. You had to pass every item in the store, and the history of the man who created this is quite amazing, Clarence Saunders, because he went on to found several other types of unique retail establishments. One was called Key Doozle, and it was where you went by and you just inserted every piece of merchandise in the store was only had one on display. And you go through and you would insert your key and turn it. You had no card. Then when you got to checkout, your order would be waiting for you.
Yeah. A little bit like the old Horn and Hardart automat, but with dry goods.
Exactly. The problem was it was too far ahead of its time. It was done in the 30s, I believe, and it was too far ahead of its time.
Huh.
But also I found in Memphis, I was doing some research, that they have a place called the Children's Museum, which has a grocery store for children in little carts and everything to teach them how to shop when they go to the grocery store.
Hmm. Well, that's fascinating. Sharon Zukin, have you been to the Piggly Wiggly Museum?
Well, it's top on my list of pilgrimages now.
Tom, thanks very much.
All right, thank you.
I wanted also to ask you, Sharon, about
yes.
One of the, again, fascinating things that you discussed is the hierarchy of shopping. That there used to be, and still are, very high-end shops, and that only a certain class of individual generally goes into, and others are discouraged one way or another, either by price or by more active measures. And then these were sort of evolved into the, you described the evolution into the department store with the more exclusive shops at the top of the stack.
Yes, and you can find that kind of hierarchy in shopping malls too, with the lower priced stores on the lower levels and the more expensive shops on top.
And then you get, however, to the big box stores, the Walmarts, if you will, the Kmarts, and there everything is back on one level.
Well, this is the very interesting and seductive thing about these big box stores, especially the ones that feature low, low prices. They look like our image of democracy. Everybody shops together. Now, it's true that you might buy the $99.95 alarm clock, and I might buy the one for $9.95.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all there in the same space at the same time, looking at the same goods. Everything is transparent. Everything is accessible to our touch. And if you buy that expensive alarm clock or coffee pot, I can see what you're doing. It's not hidden away from me. By the same token, the low, low prices appeal to everybody now, and everybody wants to be democratic enough to say that they pay attention to price. In my book, Point of Purchase, I quote Ivana Trump, the former wife of real estate magnate Donald Trump here in New York,
mm-hmm.
who says that she goes shopping in Costco for olive oil with her chef. Now, what does she know about cooking? But she says, oh, yes, I don't really know the price, but I like the fact that that olive oil is cheap.
We're talking about how shopping defines us as Americans, and we're taking your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. How does where and how you shop compare to your parents or your grandparents? Do you think the stuff you buy says something about you? And what are you teaching your kids about how to shop? When we come back, we'll also talk about the man who invented the mall. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the ways in which we shop and what it says about us. And, of course, you're invited to join the discussion. If you cruise malls or head to flea markets, do you remember the first purchase you made on your own? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And our guest is Sharon Zukin. She's the author of Point of Purchase, How Shopping Changed American Culture. She's with us from our bureau in New York. And joining us now here in Studio 3A is Jeffrey Hardwick. He's the author of a book called Mallmaker, Victor Gruen, Architect of an American Dream. And Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Who is Victor Gruen?
Gruen was, he's got a pretty complicated life. He was born in Vienna and was a, had a strange career for a commercial architect in that he was a pretty fervent socialist originally and worked in the theater doing socialist plays in Vienna. And then when Hitler came into Vienna in 1938, he left and immigrated to New York first and then L.A. and found a niche for himself in commercial architecture.
And had a vision of an American utopian marketplace.
Yeah, he did. He was a definitely a showman, if nothing else. He sort of banked on the fact that he could combine profit, sort of private profit, and pleasure for people. And one of his legacies for retailing is what it becomes known as the Gruen effect, which is that feeling of walking into a grocery store or chain store or mall and being so sort of bedazzled and taken over by all the goods and the fountains and the sounds that you completely forget what you have come there to shop for and just begin sort of automatically consuming and grabbing things off the shelves. Exactly what Professor Zukin was talking about in terms of a rational consumer. Gruen really wanted to create an irrational consumer.
But his vision of how this mall would look and how it would work was a little different about than how it turned out.
Yes. Originally, he imagined that it would both combine public benefit and private profit. And so he, in many rhetorical statements, goes over the top in saying how malls are going to be this wonderful public benefit, and they're going to bring the theater and town halls and libraries and daycare and art and sort of mix culture with commercialism. And he really sort of fervently believed this. Of course, it ends up being left on the drawing board, many of those plans. Although in a couple of them, he does get smaller theaters built. In one, Randhurst outside Chicago, they build a bomb shelter in the original mall. So there's occasional sort of, in his mind, successes. Although he ends up, by the end of his career, just hating sort of what developers have done with the idea of a enclosed shopping mall.
And wants them all torn down.
Wants them torn down and sort of sees American society as taking his wonderful idea and bastardizing it.
Hmm.
Those are that's what he actually says.
Sharon Zukin, now what place do you think that the mall plays in our world of shopping today?
The mall has been supremely important in furnishing all those homes in suburbia, putting chickens in the oven, and by concentrating all those functions that Jeffrey Hardwick just mentioned, the malls have become the only public space in most of the inhabited United States. Unfortunately, the centralization has really deprived the rest of the living space of the vitality that it needs. I thought that Gruen had an ideal originally of trying to bring the city to the country and trying to recreate some of the dynamism of city streets in a mall. By the same token, that dynamism just doesn't exist outside of an urban center.
Is that your understanding of Mr. Gruen's work, Jeffrey Hardwick?
Yes, definitely. Gruen's both looking back at his European upbringing and Vienna specifically, but then also looking at, I mean, the model for successful commercial establishments and sort of the activity and hustle and bustle that we think of was downtown. And so he definitely talks about over and over that he's going to bring downtown out to the suburbs and give the new suburbanites of the 50s this new downtown and cultural center where they can go. And they also see it in a weird twist, and I guess something we wouldn't think about, but they also see the mall as a way to stop sprawl. They sort of imagine that by concentrating all the functions, grocery stores and dentist's office and department stores all together at the mall, that you won't then have the proliferation of all the strips and all the commercial strips and
The strip malls that
right, exactly.
Not his invention. Sharon Zukin, though, one of the things, again, I think we may have mentioned, alluded to this earlier, but you talked about the hierarchy of malls and how they're structured and how that replicates in a way the old department store.
Yes, that's true. The more exclusive shops are on the higher levels of the mall, and the cheaper shops, as well as the food court, are down in the bargain basement. So that some people, I guess, never take that escalator up to the third level.
Well, let's get some more callers on the line, and let's go to Tim. And Tim joins us from St. Simon's Island in Georgia.
Good afternoon. Neil and Sharon, I have a miscellaneous question that I've always wondered about. Why are grocery stores laid out from right to left? The front entrance always seems to be on the left-hand side, so I shop left to right, which is fine unless I've got more than a half an hour of frozen ice cream in the bottom of my cart. and I've asked grocery store managers, and I'm hoping there's at least a practical reason or at least a tradition behind it.
So the entrance to the store is on the right-hand side, did you say?
Most entrances, main entrances, are generally on the left-hand side.
Yeah.
On the left-hand
but
side.
Grocery
well,
stores are laid out from right to left.
They tend to have the
yes.
Yeah, the vegetables and stuff over on the right and the
exactly, and the frozen
well,
on the left.
Well, yeah. You know, New York City is just perverse, I guess, because my local supermarket is laid out the opposite way.
Oh, really?
Well, the fresh vegetables are on the left, and the frozen foods, which you would pick up last before heading to the cashier, are on the right. So I guess I've got
Tears and the Winn-Dixies. I mean, even the numbering of the aisles is right to left, 1 through 15 or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you're really an astute shopper if you pay attention to the numbers of the aisles.
Oops, I think Tim's cell phone just maybe it needs to buy a new cell phone. Anyway, Tim, thanks very much for the call. And I wanted to follow up. Here's an email we got from Rachel and Glenn in Wichita, Kansas. A grocer in Oklahoma City saw his customers come in with one shopping basket on their arm. He thought if he could make it easier for them to bring in two baskets, he'd increase sales. So he designed a rolling rack with two open shelves of angle iron to hold two baskets. The rest is development, as you say, to SUV size. So there's the story of the birth of the shopping cart, or at least what this version of it is.
No, I have heard that. I believe that's a true history. It's important to put a date on that. It's early. It's in the 1930s.
Okay. Jeffrey Hardwick, before we leave you, we need to find out what happened to Victor Gruen in the end. We know what happened to his idea.
Gruen ends up doing simultaneously large downtown urban renewal programs, mm-hmm. and so he's doing projects across America. At the same time, he's doing his malls, and essentially he becomes very bitter in his old age. He retires in 68, leaves the States, moves back to Vienna, and retreats into writing science fiction, writes one more book where he complains that America is 17 suburbs in search of a real city. He ends up being an incredible critic of his, essentially what he helped popularize, the mall.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Hardwick is an editor at Smithsonian Books and the author of Mallmaker, Victor Gruen, Architect of an American Dream. He was with us here in Studio 3A. Still with us is Sharon Zukin. She's the author of Point of Purchase. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Beth, who's with us from Ithaca, New York.
Hi there, Neil. I'm a closet shopper.
Closet shopper.
I live in Ithaca, New York, and I'm not sure how many of you are really familiar with that place, but it's a pretty green town, and it's pretty, like, anti-development, anti-big box store, and we've just gotten a Target within the last couple years. And
how do you all feel about that?
Well, I can't speak for the town. That's the problem. Like, all my friends will say, oh, I have to go to the mall. Oh, I hate going to the mall. And I'll be right with them, like, oh, yeah, I hate it. But, like, silently, like to myself, I'm like, oh, yes, I have to go to the mall. I get to, like, cruise around Target and see what's new. And my husband's a grad student, so it's not like I spend a lot of money. But just going and seeing all the stuff, it's just really fun. It's like entertainment for me.
Sharon, I suspect that Beth is not alone.
No, I think Beth has put her finger on the great original appeal of Woolworths in the 1870s and Walmart from the 1960s on. And
see,
that
is... Victim.
Well, it's don't talk about victim. You are underserved, right? You are underserved if you don't have a way to see what is new, what is exciting. Now, I'm not saying I advocate that, but I understand the appeal of these stores in a place like Ithaca. And by the way, I just heard yesterday that Oberlin, Ohio is looking to get a Walmart. So, you know, these college towns with an anti-mall ideology, well, they're going to fall like dominoes.
Well, Beth, where are you going to go closet shopping next?
Well, I'm in love with our grocery store. Wegmans is a regional chain, and they just have absolutely everything. And they give my one-year-old a free balloon every time we go.
Now there's value for
you. There is major value right there.
Beth, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Sharon Zukin, before we let you go,
yes.
I wanted to get you to talk a little bit about your idea about how shopping is a form of democracy and the tension between the sense of creativity that we sometimes feel and the control that we are sometimes under.
I think we shoppers are stymied by having too much choice and not enough choice. This is the great strength of consumer society. By the same token, this is the great appeal that capitalism advertises over all its adversaries. So we have all these products to choose from, but everybody has a shopping story about how they can't find what they really need. Shopping is a way for us to exercise choice. It's a way for us to hone our rationality, to teach our values to our children and our siblings whom we shop with.
To exercise what you describe as the archetypical need to go out and hunt and gather food.
Oh, that's true. That's true. This is the way we hunt and gather today. But this kind of democracy hides some of the real problems with our society. If you are a dark-skinned shopper like Artemio, whom I describe in one of my chapters, Artemio Goes to Tiffany's, you may encounter severe obstacles in trying to spend your hard-earned money on an expensive gift for your girlfriend. And when you try to go to Tiffany, if you don't fit into the way the Tiffany salespeople and security guards think you should fit in, then you're hassled. And shopping, it does not let you think that racial hierarchies are completely dispensed with. Or if you're Ivana Trump shopping for olive oil, great, you're getting a bargain. But what about the person next to you who's using food stamps and really can't afford the olive oil?
Sharon Zukin's book is Point of Purchase, How Shopping Changed American Culture. She was with us from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Neil.